Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Tony Pankaluik, coming to you from Radio 4EB in Mianjin, Brisbane. And today on the show...
So the program brings together two groups of people who would not ordinarily meet. So the university students and people in custody. So what happens is they spend a semester studying together. So 12 weeks. Essentially a university classroom transcends into a prison.
A program supporting people in custody and studying criminology has been nominated for an award. We have all the details. Also, traditional owners in Queensland are outraged by a crocodile being relocated kilometres away from its homeland. And later today...
The music is like a language, so we want people who can come up with a skill that can actually speak to people in a different way.
Find out how a Sydney-based music group is connecting people of all walks of life with groovy music from the Southern African region. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia, thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, earlier this week, the federal government announced it will introduce a bill aimed at enforcing regulations on major streaming giants to invest in locally produced Australian content. The bill is seen as a long time coming by industry insiders, though not all details are currently known. I spoke with lecturer in digital communication at RMIT's University's School of Media and Communication, Dr. Alexa Scatolata, to find out more.
So it's been a long road to streaming regulation in Australia. They've been left to operate unregulated, do their own thing, whatever they like, for more than a decade. Meanwhile, in Europe, you know, they imposed a 30% content quota in 2018, and Canada updated their broadcast regulations to kind of require online streaming services to contribute content in Canada as well. So in Australia, meanwhile, we've had kind of 8 official inquiries, a terrible waste of public resources into whether and how to regulate the streaming services. Consecutive governments have kind of kicked the can along, trying to figure out the best model. And of course, the streamers have banded together to lobby really hard against multiple proposed models, saying we're making enough stuff. Look at Heartbreak High and look at Boy Swallows Universe. Look at these great Australian titles we're making. And then we saw the Labor government kind of make an election promise to act on this and made a formal commitment. They promised regulation by July last year, and that deadline came and went. So this is a really exciting week to have some clear and concise regulation in place finally. The local production sector is no doubt sighing a big sigh of relief.
What do we know about this new legislation on how it will operate? Because I understand things are in flux, but what are the sort of the conditions, if you go into detail about that?
So yesterday, a bill was introduced and kind of read in the House of Representatives. The Labor government has introduced a bill to Parliament that will impose regulatory obligations on major subscription video on demand services that are operating in Australia. So those big services that have a subscription model and that have at least 1 million Australian subscribers. So that's the threshold. So we're really talking about the big players here, Netflix, Disney Plus, Prime Video, but also scoop up local services with ties to broadcasters. So Stan is owned by Nine, and more likely this will apply to them. Paramount owns Paramount Plus and 10, and Paramount Plus, this will also apply to them. But it does carve out a kind of exception for YouTube because it's largely user-generated content. It's not curated. So we're just talking about the major streaming services that are operating in Australia. Should this bill pass, they will have to support the production of some specific key genres. So local drama, children's content, documentary, arts and educational programming. And the thing is, it's very much up to the streamers themselves to choose a way to do this. They can choose to either invest at least 10% of their total expenditure for Australia, so whatever they spend getting their platform ready and available to Australians, or 7.5% of their total revenue that's generated in Australia every year. So just to give you some context, you know, Netflix is the market leader and has been since it launched in 2015. This means they can choose between either spending $125 million via the expenditure model or $97.5 million. No doubt via the revenue model. No doubt they're going to go for the cheaper option, but with them being able to make that choice. But we are talking about a really important and wonderful injection into the local screen sector. Back of the envelope early estimates suggest that we're going to see $300 million a year being kind of guaranteed for the Australian production sector when this legislation passes.
And what about some of the uncertainties? So individuals in the industry are still sort of questioning what will happen, how things will go. If you can talk a bit about that aspect.
Okay, so while this does provide a bit of certainty when it comes to how much the streamers have to spend, and it will mean a bit of a boost in production because the streamers have self-reported that they've been spending around $300 million anyway, but that's largely on licensing existing titles, existing stuff that the broadcasters have made. They only come in and make like a handful of new things. So we do have this boost of production coming. But what's not clear, and what's not clear in this bill, is how many discrete titles, the kind of number of things they have to make, and the discrete number of hours they have to make. So just to give you a bit of context, the commercial broadcasters have, since the 60s, had to make a certain number of hours of kids' content, drama, etc. And they have to show this Australian content between 6 a.m. and midnight on their channels. 55% of that time has to be Australian content. So what we won't know for sure is whether or not Netflix and its competitors will be able to stream into Australia, spend a significant chunk of their obligations on one movie or a single high-budget drama and then slip back out again. So it doesn't provide us with the kind of scale and consistency that could sustain jobs and nurture talent and provide industry training, which is really what the local sector needs. There's also some concerns that I have about whether or not what these streamers make as part of their obligations will actually reach the viewers via their algorithmically personalized interfaces. So in Europe and in Canada, their streaming regulation has what's called prominent obligations as well, where the streamers have to report on how visible they're making the local content that they're producing in those regions. Where in Australia, you know, we could see content that's being made buried, and that's really concerning, and that content that we're obliging the services to make, it really has to be discoverable.
So how do you think local commercial television broadcasters are reacting?
We haven't heard from them directly, but I imagine that while the production sector is breathing something of a sigh of relief, the commercial broadcasters are kind of sucking in air and are kind of struggling to breathe at the moment. Broadcast TV is in decline and streaming is now more popular, facing a lot of challenges, and the commercial free-to-air stations now stand to face a lot more competition for production labour and facilities if the streamers are coming in.
That was Dr. Alexa Scarlatta from RMIT University ending the story. A Victorian program supporting incarcerated Australians studying a subject on crime and justice has been nominated for its positive impact. The Inside Out program, developed by RMIT University with Corrections Victoria, allows criminology students to study inside a prison along with people in custody. The program celebrated its 10th anniversary, and the wise Eduardo Jordan asked Associate Professor in Criminology and Justice at RMIT University, Marietta Martinovich, to explain more about the program.
So over the last 10 years, I have been delivering a program called Inside Out Prison Exchange Program in partnership with Corrections Victoria across 8 of Victorian prisons. And what the program does, it allows incarcerated people to study a subject on crime and justice together with university students. And this program has been recognised for its positive impact as a finalist in the Shaping Australia Award this year.
Oh, well, congratulations on being nominated for this award. How do you feel about this?
I feel really proud, I think is the word. Humble and proud, but it's been a huge, I think, you know, work of passion over the last 10 years, absolutely.
Now, how have you seen over the last 10 years, how have you seen the participants' reactions about the program and its perceptions?
So the program brings together two groups of people who would not ordinarily meet. So the university students and people in custody. So what happens is they spend a semester studying together. So 12 weeks, essentially a university classroom transcends into a prison. So the outside students are attending a prison for 2 hours a week. And, you know, this is a really incredible experience, as you can imagine, for the outside students. And so what they get to do and see is they get to see the people in prison as humans. And this is really important because they get this rare insight into the human and social elements of incarceration. And that's really, really important because there's always more to a person than a headline that's been written about them or a story in the media. And it also propels them to then think about, well, what kind of a professional career do I want to have? Do I want to do something that is, you know, about rehabilitation and about, you know, enhancing the possibility of justice for people in the system? And often the answer is yes. But for the people on the inside, prison, it builds their self-esteem. It builds their motivation, their critical thinking skills, leads them to further education, and most importantly, employment. And we know that those two used as ways to actually reduce the level of possibility that they'll come back into the life of crime. So it's win-win all around.
And besides receiving education and being in contact with students and all that, what other feedback have you received from incarcerated participants about the program about the curriculum?
Look, the incarcerated students really love to be engaged in anything, especially if it's a program delivered by people from the outside, so by a university staff member. They absolutely love engaging and interacting with people on the outside, which is the, you know, RMIT students, because it's something different. It's something that, you know, 2 hours a week, there are positive, engaging conversations that are fun, that they can contribute to. And, you know, what I always find is that they're happy to do the readings, they're happy to do the writing, and they really put 100% in. And that, for an educator like myself, is really powerful. The other thing that I've heard is that they write a different narrative about themselves, and their families start to see a different narrative about the person in custody, and also really powerful as ways of stopping the world of criminal activity and re-engaging pro-socially in the world post-incarceration.
And what's the future work of this project for the next 10 years? What are you expecting?
Goodness, I always dream big. So that's an incredible question that you ask. Shouldn't ask me that question. I think, look, I would really like to have similar programs across our nation because I feel like they're just so powerful, so important. In that they have such good benefits all around, creating a more humane, more equal society, more aware society, educated society, that I would really like for there to be programs, similar programs across Australia.
That was Associate Professor at RMIT University, Marietta Martinovic, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Tony Pankaluwik in Brisbane. A big hello to our friends in Alice Springs on 8CCC, to our listeners in Taree on 2 Bob Radio, and to the other side of the country to Radio Gulari in Broome, Western Australia. You may have heard about a crocodile named Old Faithful who was featured along Steve Irwin in Queensland. Old Faithful was living in far north Queensland at the Renew Lakefield National Park, but was relocated to Australia Zoo. Traditional owners are outraged. Old Faithful, who was considered a family member, was taken nearly 2,000 kilometres away from home and fearing his health might deteriorate. The Wire's contributor from NADA Media, Marley Ryan, spoke with chairperson of the Renew Lakeville Aboriginal Corporation, Alwyn Lyall, about this situation.
Well, first and foremost, if you can't see the bottom, you don't put your foot in it. And in regards to management of crocodiles, our mob, we're more about managing the nests. And if there was a crocodile who was dangerous to people, then he would be taken out. He would be removed from the system. Crocodiles only learn this sort of behavior from human interaction. It's the human who's causing the problems with the crocodile. The crocodile in his natural habitat has plenty of wildlife, you know. A human comes into his habitat and then that human becomes part of his menu, eh, you know. So the best way to protect yourself is be croc wise in croc country.
How and when did you first learn that Old Faithful had been removed?
I signed off on the removal of the crocodile in the beginning. It wasn't until after it was removed that we found out that it was a case of mistaken identity. The crocodile who was actually doing the wrong thing was a smaller crocodile. He was 3.2 meters long. He had one of his back feet were missing and about a foot of his tail was also missing. It looked like he hadn't had a good feed for quite some time, as all his rib bones were sticking out and you could see his spine stood out predominantly, you know. And because he shared the same water hole with Old Faithful, when they went in there and trapped him, they took out both crocodiles, and not just the problem one, but the iconic 4.2 meter crocodile, Old Faithful. And when I went to the depot in Cairns where they held him, I'm not a croc expert, but even I could see the difference between Old Faithful and the starving crocodile. And I could understand that the starving crocodile be looking for a feed from the fishermen. I've asked the state government and the wildlife team to actually provide me with the evidence of this crocodile being a problem crocodile. Who made the complaints? When did they make these complaints? Is there any video footage of this crocodile actually attacking people? To this day, nobody has been able to provide us with any of that information.
And are there any cultural or spiritual consequences from removing Old Faithful?
I think there's an environmental issue, because now that crocodile's taken out of the system, there's going to be other crocodiles coming into that system. Those ones are not really known or they haven't been around people. It could cause a lot more trouble than when Old Faithful was in there. The cultural aspect of it, like losing a family member, is like having a funeral at home here, you know. Even though that crocodile is still alive, he's no longer here on country. I've been saying all along, animals have spent more than 80 years living in that waterhole, and it takes a couple of irresponsible fishermen come along there, do the wrong thing around him, and then that crocodile gets called a rogue crocodile. At the moment, the wildlife team are looking at three other crocodiles in our national park, and I won't be signing no more removals. I'd rather stop people from coming in our national park and fishing before they remove any more crocodiles. We've asked the state government to help us develop a proper crocodile management program for our crocodiles in Lakefield. The best scenario that we can come up is to have a sanctuary on country that looks after our own animals. This year alone, there's been three crocodiles removed from Lakefield.
And what would a respectful solution look like to you? Would you want Old Faithful returned or cultural protocols observed in another way?
We've already said that we want that crocodile returned here to Lakefield. We want to see a sanctuary built within Lakefield National Park. And any other problem crocodiles that might arise from human interaction, we can manage and look after them in a cultural and appropriate way on country, rather than sending them off to some foreign zoo down south somewhere, you know. The other thing I'd like to say in regard is that they gave us a few options on where we wanted to send that crocodile, and nobody agreed for that crocodile to go to the Australian Zoo. We had a sanctuary down in Babinda, which is only 400 kilometres away from Lakefield, and we would have been able to go and visit him and see that crocodile whenever we wanted to. But now that he's been taken 2,000 kilometres away, no family would be able to travel down there and see him. And for the Australian Zoo to try and say that they're providing a home for this unwanted crocodile, he's not an unwanted crocodile. He has a home, but government just failed to put a proper management in place so that he could continue to live his life out on country, you know? like Old Faithful Waterhole. There's 50 other campsites in Lakefield National Park. We could have just shut that one down and nobody would even know that old crocodile lived there. What we're working on right now is that we have about 200,000 visitors coming to our park every year, and they all got to do an online camping permit. They can't just come in the park. They got to online book their places. So we're going to come up with a three-minute croc-wise video. Everybody who comes in Lakefield has to watch that video before they get a permit. During the peak tourism seasons, we're going to implement rangers to go down and do croc-wise talks at the most populated camping site on the park. But we've got to come up with some sort of better management plan than that's currently in existence, which is nothing. The only plan is to remove crocodiles, and that's not good enough for us.
That was chairperson of Renew Lakefield Aboriginal Cooperation, Alwyn Lyle. Speak with Nada Media's Marley Ryan. Music plays an integral role across all cultures around the globe, and to celebrate its importance, Brisbane's festival's Maruka Block Party showcased many multicultural performers. One band is committed to entertaining and engaging people of all walks of life with inspiring music from Southern Africa. The Sydney-based Echoes of African Music performed on the day, grooving crowds with their beats. I spoke with a lead singer and backup vocalist from Echoes of Africa, Francis Peary, to find out more about the band and why music plays such a crucial role in our lives.
Oh, my name is Francis Peary, and I sing in a band called Echoes of African Music. I'm one of the lead singers, and I also do backing vocals. I'm originally from Malawi, but I was born and bred in Zimbabwe. So the band is mainly composed of people that come from Zimbabwe. When we moved over here to Australia, we actually continued with our music love. And while we were loving music, we've been, you know, coming together, watching people sing and play. And we came together, myself and Simba, and another Simba. So we've got two Simbas in the team, one who plays the lead guitar and the other one would play his percussion, and I sing, and we came together and formed a band about 10 years ago, and we've been singing around Sydney. We usually have a Zimbabwean community gala where we usually play together and we sing for the crowds. We also get involved in other states. We've been invited in Townsville where we play at the Townsville Festival. Here at Maruka is the first time. We've come here to Maruka because I believe the organizers have seen our name that we actually perform, and they actually invited us to perform.
Yeah, so tell us about like the style of music you play. So obviously Africa, I'd imagine there's different elements from various parts of the regions you might bring together. So you can tell us about just the music and everything.
Yeah, so our type of music is called chigio, but we do get a lot of inspiration from African jazz, Afro jazz, like the type of music that was played by the likes of Louis Mtlanga, Don Gumbo, Yuma Segela in South Africa. And we actually try and create our own style of music, but having the background of Afro jazz. But our type of music is called chigio. Having said that, we also have other artists that actually came to join our band. A brother from Ghana is a very good keyboard player, and another brother from Nigeria is a very good drum player. So we actually fuse in different styles of music to create our own style, which is called chigio.
So what do you guys look for when it's bringing everybody together just to form the band? Obviously, they've got to have the skills and everything, but what are some elements you like to see in these artists and bring them together?
I would say the main thing is just, you know, someone who is easy to get along with, and someone with a skill that is different from the other team members, but someone who can bring the skill that would actually come together with our already having skills to form up something that will come out nice for the people. So we look for someone who is humble, someone who is disciplined, because we do have practices and we also need to get together and living from different places. Like I live in Orange, and the brother that we sing with lives in Wagga Wagga in New South Wales, and the band leader Simba lives in Sydney, and the other few guys live in there. So we try to make sure that we can have some discipline when we say it's time for practicing. We all come together and practice, and those different skills actually come together and bring up beautiful music. And I would say also the other thing is music is like a language. So we want people who can come up with a skill that can actually speak to people in a different way. So some of the skills could actually come up as a healing factor to people that listen to the music. Some of them would make people feel better and have motivated to do things. So in other words, it also helps as therapy for them, make them all have a good life.
What's your favorite song to perform?
I love to perform Shosholoza. Shosholoza is a song that actually brings people together. It talks about the melodies that we are bringing all the way from Africa. Most of those lyrics and some of the melodies that we bring together, it's resemblance of sounds coming from the mountains, coming from the forests, that actually speaks to people and bring them good vibes. So it's called Shosholoza.
This will be my last question. You sort of touched upon it earlier, but what role does music bring in vast cultures together from all the continents, like what it brings to people?
Yeah, music brings people together. It's a different language altogether. It's a language that actually brings people together. Like we can hear the drums playing now. People from different cultures can actually dance along to that drum beat. It actually brings people together in a way that they connect. It's a language that whoever loves to have peace, whoever loves to have joy, can actually join together and come together, be together as one, and just enjoy. So it brings people together, communicates to people in different ways.
That was Francis Peary from Echoes of Africa, ending the report. And that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER, Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ, and Radio 4EB in Melbourne and Brisbane, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and Community Radio Network. We'll see you next week, same time, on your local station. And if you'd like to hear any one of our stories again, you can go to our website at thewire.org.au. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Turrbal and Yuggera country, where this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders, past, present, and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from Radio 4EB in Brisbane. I'm Tony Pankaluik. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.